Cecil Upchurch's mental collapse was as sudden as it was shocking and unexpected. One moment he was drilling his company in a camp behind the lines, and the next he was lying listless on a bed, barely able to move or speak. Though he didn't know it then, the architect-turned-soldier had fallen victim to what medics in later conflicts would call battle exhaustion and what was known, euphemistically, in the First World War as shell shock. Sometimes triggered by a single harrowing episode, it was more often the cumulative consequence of prolonged exposure to the haphazard danger posed by a relentless artillery fire, raining death and destruction on squalid, ill-protected trenches. In Upchurch's case, the breakdown was attributed to having been badly shaken by a shell burst that left him concussed, but most likely it was merely the tip of an iceberg of emotional and physical strain that had sapped the last reserves of strength and courage that he possessed. During a little more than a month on the Somme in the autumn of 1916, he had endured the tragedy and trauma of seeing his battalion shattered for the second time in a year. So many of his friends from the 9th Norfolks had gone, either killed or wounded, he barely recognised the unit from the one he had joined as a civilian volunteer in Norwich in the summer of 1914. Lewes, where he had been seriously wounded and his battalion decimated in September 1915, was bad enough, but the agonies suffered on the Somme were on an altogether different scale. The tortured landscape was something beyond description, with trenches that were so knocked about that many men sheltered as best they could in shell craters. "Heavens," wrote Upchurch, "it is war with a vengeance. The noise is terrific, and since we got there, there's been absolutely no cessation of our shells screaming over, and, of course, quite enough of theirs." One of his closest friends, a fellow officer, was already in the advanced stages of shell shock with his nerves all over the place, even before the battalion made its entry into the battle on September the 15th. The attack on a formidable German position, known as the Quadrilateral, proved disastrous. Despite the support of four tanks, the new engines of war, as Upchurch referred to them, the battalion made no progress at a cost of some 430 men dead, injured or missing. "It is sickening," wrote Upchurch, who, as adjutant, observed it all from a shell hole that served as battalion headquarters. "The poor old Ninth got it in the neck. They never have the luck." Describing the advance a day later, he noted, "The men were marvellous, going up and down under violent rifle fire at the walk, most of them smoking pipes or cigarettes. We are now under command of another battalion as the whole brigade got it hot." The fighting took place northeast of Guimont, a village in name only, comprising merely a few tree stumps and not a brick, and the tanks were of little assistance. One of them had mistaken the Norfolks for the enemy and opened fire on the troops as they were preparing to attack. "We all thought they'd either be a great success or a hopeless failure," wrote Upchurch. "Where we were, it was the latter." The 9th Norfolks was left a pale shadow of its former self. With the loss of so many officers, Upchurch found himself in charge of the remains of two companies merged into a single unit, representing roughly half the battalion which was undergoing drastic reorganisation. It was a wretched time, full of stressful toil and constant change made worse by the beastly weather that turned the ground into a quagmire. Weary beyond measure, Upchurch's mood grew bleaker and his letters more downbeat. To his fiancée Hilda he wrote on October the 2nd, "I think we could all do with a bit of a leave to get rid of some of our fed-upness." Unhappy with the new battalion regime, which he found quite dismal, he complained, "It doesn't seem like the old Ninth at all." The signs of nervous exhaustion were so gradual as to go unrecognised until it was too late. Just as the unit was preparing to return to the fray, Upchurch's nerve finally cracked. Sent back to a rest camp on doctor's instructions, his condition grew steadily worse. Having carried on for a month after being blown up, his body and mind finally shut down. Writing to Hilda on October the 26th, he said, "I take white pills daily and lie in bed and do nothing. I'm sure the others in here find me a lively companion, as there's nothing to talk about except war, and I hate talking about that, so usually I don't talk at all." The following day, having been removed to a casualty clearing station further back, he observed, "They seem to think I want a real change and I don't care. I have done absolutely nothing but lie still and blink at the ceiling. But it's been a relief to lie still and do nothing." His fighting war was over. In less than a week, he was hospitalised in England with nervous debility and shell shock. It was the beginning of a long ordeal, marked by bouts of insomnia, bad dreams, and a depression that left his nerves unstable for months after. Recovery came slowly. Over time, the nightmares receded, and his health improved sufficiently for him to return to duty in a training role. The veteran of Loos and the Somme, laid low not by bullets or shrapnel, but by shattered nerves, saw out the rest of the war in England. But Upjohn had not quite done with the conflict that had so terribly scarred him, psychologically as well as physically. As the men came home to resume their old lives, Upjohn poured all his efforts into honouring the near 6,000 members of his regiment who did not return, and the many more men whose injuries to body and mind had changed them forever. His grand design for a group of memorial cottages on the edge of Mousehold, dedicated to the gallant memory of those of the Norfolk Regiment who gave their lives for their country, became a reality in the spring of 1921. And among the first regimental residents, all of whom had been variously injured during the war, was a sergeant whose wounds were listed as shell shock. Almost a century on, this unusually homely monument to sacrifice endures as an act of remembrance from a man who knew better than most the true meaning of suffering.